I see we've been not that successful in resisting a very conservative attitude. So we need to have a different attitude towards history. We need to look at the history with the idea of how do you estrange or make less hegemonic the discourses in Russia.
Und herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen und diesmal englischsprachigen Folge von History and Politics, dem Podcast der Körber Stiftung zu Geschichte und Politik. My name is Gabrielle Wojdelko. I'm the head of the History and Politics Department at Körber Stiftung in Hamburg. And as always, this episode deals with the question why and how history shapes the present. This time, our focus is on Russia. As part of our podcast series, The Empire Strikes Back, we want to explore the legacies of the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union on Russia's foreign and domestic politics today. In the light of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we explore questions such as which aspects of Russia's imperial past are politically misused to legitimize the war against Ukraine? To what extent and how are President Putin and the political elites fulfilling the advice given to Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union that Russia needs to become a nation state? Which role does the Soviet Union or the public image that is created of the Soviet Union in today's Russia play at all for the country's expansionist great power politics? And what, last but not least, is the role of historians in all this? I had the pleasure to discuss these questions with the Russian historian Alexander Semyonov. He is an expert in the history of empire and diversity. Until the outbreak of the Russian war against Ukraine, he was the head of history department at the Higher School of Economics in St. Petersburg, but he resigned from his position after 24th of February 2022. Meanwhile, Alexander has left Russia. He is the editor of the Up Imperio journal, an academic journal that deals with new transnational ways of approaching the history of empires and has a special focus on entanglements and diversity. So, stay tuned if you want to learn more about the multiple ways of how the Empire Strikes Back in the case of today's Russia. And please, do not hesitate to recommend our podcast to others if you find it interesting. We've recently brushed up our podcast website and we've also developed a new podcast visual so that it's even more attractive to spread the word about what we are doing with our history and politics episodes. But now let's get started about Russia, the empire, nationalism, and the future. Sasha Semyonov, welcome to the History and Politics podcast.
Thank you for the invitation.
It's very nice to have you with us. And, you know, we are talking to each other as part of a series we have in our podcast, which is about the legacy of empires. We call it The Empire Strikes Back. And it's all about the repercussions of empires in the present. And today we are going to talk about Russia, about the repercussions of empire in Russia today. And I would like to start with a very recent episode. A couple of days ago, the Russian president visited an exhibition in Moscow that was organized on the occasion of the 350th birthday of the Russian Tsar Peter the Great. Putin paid tribute to the Tsar, and he said that both Peter the Great and obviously Russia today share a historic quest to return Russian lands and or to bring back land that originally belonged to Russia. And yeah, it was clear that he made a connection to the current war in Ukraine. So Putin was using this idea of or the connection between Peter the Great and current Russian politics very recently. So what do you think? Which aspects of Russia's imperial past are the major ones that are politically used or misused by the Russian president currently? I mean, you are an expert on imperial history and diversity. So what is your view? What is the main focus? What imperial past is Putin using and why?
Terrific question. Thank you again for the invitation. And I would like to start with an observation that recently, well, we were talking about the past, actually two decades, Russian politics and political ideology and propaganda has been dominated by the memory, by references to the past. This is not a healthy situation. That means that we are substituting, we are replacing questions about the future, the present and the future, with this hegemonic, all-empowering references to the past. And that, of course, is also reveals the fact that there is very little imagination about the future. So everything is about the past. So Empire Strikes Back, but it's also, as we wrote in our journal Ab Imperio, forward to the past. We are very quickly moving forward, but we are not moving into the future. We're moving into the past. And many people actually commented on that, that this is very strange. That means that there is very little positive agenda, that the regime that was formed after Yeltsin and inherited much of the post-Soviet Russian political climate is very conservative. That means that it doesn't have a daring imagination of how to meet the global challenges of the future. Right. So this is the one point I want to underscore. The overwhelming presence of history, the almost omnipresence of history in the Russian official politics. Now, you've mentioned Peter the Great. The theme of Peter the Great, of course, was with Vladimir Putin for some time. He's coming from Leningrad, St. Petersburg, and there's a sort of a regional identification with the history of the city. But also, when we look historically at the period of transformation of the Muscovite state into the Russian Empire that is usually credited to Peter the Great, many people forget how erratic the reforms of Peter the Great were, how much was done in the 17th century rather than in the 18th century, that is, before Peter the Great, than actually by him. And recently, historiography, professional historians who are writing in this period actually say that the real formation of the institutes and norms and really the shapes of cities, of imperial cities in the 18th century, they are all back to Catherine the Great, not Peter the Great. So the famous one, Peter built a huge Russian navy. It all got destroyed and rotten in the course of the 18th century. So Catherine the Great had to rebuild the entire navy to go against the Ottoman Empire in the Mediterranean. So much more credit should be given to Catherine the Great for that.
This is quite interesting, and I'm sure we come back to that because this goes into the legacies of different Russian tsars and empresses. But let me get back to the connection between history and politics. When you were talking about the omnipresence of history in the Russian political discourse for, as far as I understand, not only the last couple of years, but almost two decades, history has been present in the political discourse. What we are seeing now since the war against Ukraine started is that it's not just about ideology. It's not about presenting history or presenting a certain narrative of history, but it's about politicizing history and it's about using history as a weapon. So let me come back to an essay the Russian president has published 1 year ago in July 2021, where he talked about Ukraine not being an independent nation state, Ukraine being founded because Russia helped to found Ukraine. I mean, it's not just ideology, it's weaponizing history. How would you describe the role history plays for the Russian president and its political system when it comes to legitimizing war, legitimizing conflict? So where do you see the connection?
The second point, there's still, if you look at the people who are around the official sort of Russian policy, they're all products of the 90s. You know, they believe in something, but they're also manipulating a lot. And even though they present themselves as historians, I don't think they are historians, you know, or they don't understand what the historical profession is about. Of course, they're using the logic of the history of the Russian state. And that's the narrative, that's the basic narrative that is around Peter the Great. That's why all the czars are important. The revolution, there was an anniversary of 1917 revolution that was played down because the revolution is the dismantling of the state, right? The breaking of the state. And so this is the state narrative of history that ignores much of global entanglements, transnational history, gender, social history, economic history for that matter. Right. And that particular type of history, you know, historians are not writing it anymore, but this is very much employed and weaponized, as you said, in the official discourse. So coming back to the original question of, you know, what is the imperial sort of legacy? It's the legacy of the idea of the Russian state, a continuity of the Russian state that is employed by the current regime. And, you know, it has sort of a certain purchase on the international market because indeed, you know, Putin is formulating the narrative that is shared by, you know, many, many professors of Russian history around the world.
Political continuity, and also, if I understand you correctly, you are saying that the Russian imperial history is politically now used in a way that it tells the history of the Russian nation state, the Russian nation. It's a Russian-dominated narrative, which is politicized.
You're quite right. I was about to say that. So first you put the state as the collective subject, as the main protagonist in your drama, right? So who is persona dramatis? Who is acting? So it's basically the state. And when you go deeper, then there is an ethno-national narrative that underpins that statist narrative, the narrative about the history of the state, right? So it is very characteristic. You've mentioned this article about the unity of Ukrainian and Russian people. So the attempts of, first of all, the Ukrainian independence as a result of World War I, very powerful movement in Ukraine in the 19th century, the national movement. The existence of different political states in the history, early modern history of Ukraine, they're all deconstructed, right? As if they were ephemeral and superficial, as if they were not real. But in the same article, when the Russian president is talking about the Russians, they are not deconstructed. They are, you know, as if they were and had been real through the course of that history. And we've known that, you know, in some of the episodes of writing national history. So some national histories are deconstructed, but others are more real than others' national histories. And the merger, the state and the nation, the ethno-national narrative, the merger of them produce the current reform. Therefore, you might remember, after the annexation of the Crimea, the commemorative politics of the Russian state was all around the late Romanovs, who, of course, had a residence in the Crimea, in the Livadia Palace. And the monument that was erected was to Alexander III. And so even in one of the articles, you know, I wrote that as the monument to Catherine the Great, the second, in Odessa, is now besieged and under the threat of deconstruction, the monument to Alexander III, right next door in the Crimea, newly minted, stands and shining under the sun, right?
So could you explain to our audience what this is telling us? I mean, if there is a new monument to Alexander III erected after the annexation of Crimea, maybe not everybody is aware
yes.
of...
Well, there was a major rupture in the 19th century, and the names of Alexander III and Nicholas II came down in history, in the political history of the Russian Empire, as the emperors who engaged in a kind of revolution against the empire. And that revolution was a national revolution. They wanted to get the Russian national project going. They wanted the Russian Empire to be more like a strong Russian nation state with colonies and dependencies. But they wanted to have that foundation based on orthodoxy, on the religion, on the language, and the whole imagination that there is this Russian people, usually rural peasant people, that is the foundation of the political architecture. And it's not accidental that the current Russian president favors Alexander III as much as he favors Peter the Great, because it's with Alexander III, well, the monument in the Crimea, as far as I remember, quotes famously that Russia does not have any allies but the Russian Navy and the Russian army. It's a kind of isolationist politics, which was, by the way, not true at the time of Alexander III, but everyone cites that apocryphal phrase from him. And this is the idea that Russia needs to become a nation state. Now, you can hear a lot of this discourse over the current Russian war against Ukraine by saying the problem with Russia, it is that it is an empire. It's not a nation state. And therefore, it has these imperial ambitions, and an aggression is part of it. But if you look very carefully at this discourse, this is a result of the advice and urging during the 90s that the real path for Russia into the 21st century is to become a normal nation state. And I'm sorry to say, but I think you are seeing the result of that wishful thinking. You know, it's a combination of unreflected legacy that was from the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union, and the idea of a nationalizing project, the idea of building a solidarity based on markers of religion, you know, hence the privileged position of the Russian Orthodox Church, based on language, which in the current version of the Constitution, it's not just the language, it's called the Russian language and the Russian people, right? So the collective, the group, is identified with particular language. And so, you know, I disagree. I'm with some of the commentators who say this is an empire. This is not an empire. This is a particular form of imperial formation, of imperial politics, where you have a very lethal combination of nationalism and imperial designs regarding the space around the political borders and the idea that the political borders do not hold.
Okay, wait a moment, Sasha, because there were a lot of topics now in your last remark. So you say Russia today is a nation state that uses imperial designs. But if I look at the Constitution, it's the Russian Federation. It's not Russia as a nation state. So how do I make sense of that?
It is the Federation, and the federal principle was introduced after the collapse of the Russian Empire. It's in the first Bolshevik Constitution of 1918. But in fact, as Lenin famously said in 1918, it's the spontaneity of the World Revolution that brought us to the Federation. The Bolsheviks were not federalist at the beginning. It was in the climate of all major political forces in the early 20th century that brought the idea of autonomy and federalism to the front stage. And really, the Bolsheviks were subdued by that consensus. They followed it rather than shaped it. And then, of course, the history of the Soviet Union, which was a union and a multinational state, and the Russian Federation, formed as a result of the exit from the Soviet Union, inherited many of these features. The idea of federalism is under-reflected currently, and because there was an urge to build a Russian nation state, the beginning of the first term of President Putin was associated with cutting down the rights of the federal units within the Bundesrepublik, within the Russian Federation, which is, again, not Russian in the ethnic sense, not Russisch, but Russländisch. It's very important, and I always use German for that. It's not Russisch, it's Russländisch. It's Российский in Russian, not Русский. And so there was an assault on this kind of federalism. There was much more centralization brought over the 2000s and in the decade of the 2010s. But if coming back to the very direct question, what about the Constitution? The Constitution of the Russian Federation, you know, last amendments 2021, it's very contradictory. So, for instance, as I've mentioned, early on, the Constitution said the Russian language is the state language in the Russian Federation. Now, there is a clause that says it's the Russian people. You can translate it as the Russian nation. That is the state-forming people of the Russian state. Now, you have a hierarchy, right? You have many nations, you have many peoples in the Federation, but one people is accorded a very particular role because it's the bearer of the state. So there is a hierarchy. And in the same next clause, it says that all the peoples in the Russian Federation have equal rights. But how do you square that with the clause that says that the Russian people are the state-bearing people? Right? So it's a contradictory project, and the trend throughout this period, post-Soviet period, was to form a national core behind the political project that is called post-Soviet Russia.
Mm. Thank you very much for mentioning post-Soviet Russia, and you have been talking about the Soviet Union already as well, because from my observation is that in the public discourse here in Germany, but also in other Western European or other European countries, there's a lot of talking about the Soviet legacy, the legacy of the Soviet Union, when it comes to try to understand what is happening now with the war against Ukraine, what has been happening since the Soviet Union fell apart in 1991, you know, the frozen conflicts in the Caucasus or other issues that the quick explanation always, or very often the quick explanation is, yeah, this is because it's Soviet legacy and the Russian political system after 91, especially under the current president who's been ruling for more than 20 years now, they have been obsessed with this Soviet heritage. They want to rebuild the Soviet Union. What do you think? I mean, is it really helpful to think about the Soviet Union and the Soviet legacy when it comes to the current conflicts or to the current war? Which role does the Soviet legacy play?
There are always, in the present, multiple legacies at work. It's like a, you know, several slices in the pie. But I do not believe in the direct transmission of certain patterns of history into the present. It's always people who pick certain elements, who think they are important, and most importantly, those who borrow the language and use the language from a different epoch for the present that is very different from the history, and also try to describe it for the future. The Soviet legacy, it's also many of them, right? In fact, Stalin made a break with the early Soviet history by insisting on implementing the project of national territorial autonomy. By choosing territory as the defining element of the national autonomy, that actually meant disrupting the larger impact of diasporic nationalities that populate this Eurasian space. So Stalin's version is opposite to the version in the 20s, a kind of hybrid revolution with lots of ideas about autonomy and new arrangement for this heterogeneous space. The Stalin's version is more like, you know, define nationality, cut all the ties, you know, make it smaller, you know, way, right? So this is very contradictory. When we are coming to the post-Soviet Russia, I think the most relevant feature of the Soviet legacy is the late Soviet legacy. Now, the late Soviet legacy was a revolt against this multinational political project. Remember, by that time, the idea of the world revolution, the idea of cosmopolitanism, they all died out. And so as a result, with Andropov, you have clearly a Russian national project winning in the hearts of former communists. And yet, if you look, and we cover that in another publication that maybe your readers will be interested to read, that's the UNESCO Commission Report on the Russian Humanities. In that publication, we carefully examine sociological surveys right after the breakup of the Soviet Union. And the question about the restoration of the Soviet Union, you know, negligible percentage. Very few people actually thought that this is very important. So the nostalgia for the Soviet Union, for the borders and the institutions, and a kind of hierarchical order with the elite and the perks that are associated with being elite, it's all actually very late. It's when the generation that experienced this transformation, of a global magnitude, by the way, the end of the Cold War and the disintegration of the Soviet Union.
It's very interesting what you say about the generational change, that you say, well, once the generation that really experienced the Soviet Union is not longer there, then we see the beginning of the political, let's say, of the imagine of creating an image of the Soviet Union that doesn't have much to do with historical facts. Would you say, is it feasible to talk about the Soviet Union as an empire? Because I see this very often in the discourse we have here in Germany and in other places. We are talking about the Soviet empire, and I'm always a bit uneasy because I'm not sure whether that is really applicable. What would you say as an expert on the topic?
The category of empire, the word that we use, is of course, it's very ambiguous. So I would say there are three meanings in the way we use empire. Number one, we actually imply a non-democratic form of polity, but not just non-democratic. It's the form of polity that introduces hierarchy and introduces kind of colonial attitude towards peripheries, so repressive and violent. And that's what the usual description of what empires are. Basically, when we want to say something bad, we call it an empire. Recently, we've discovered that most of the states and most of the societies in history were empires. In what sense? In the sense that being part of a larger space was actually better, was more advantageous than being part of a local, you know, very homogenous, very national or ethnic pure space. And another theme that is associated with the category of empire is the idea of cosmopolitanism and universalism. And today, in the global age, we actually like to be cosmopolitan without quite realizing that the trade routes, say, out of Hamburg to colonial Africa, were created in the time of the Weltpolitik and were created and based in with the idea that there is this kind of political agency supporting the globalization and connections that we call global history these days. And the third element is the idea of diversity. Now, diversity is still very difficult. Most of our societies today are very diverse. We deal with migrants, we deal with different religions, we deal with different races, we deal with gender diversity, with sexual diversity. That's also part of all modern societies. And usually when we talk about empires, we imply that this is the space where diversity is experienced. Not always for good, because it creates a lot of conflicts.
But it is part of the empire.
But exactly. That's part of it. If you want to be big, you have to experience that diversity. So coming back to your question, you know, what people usually mean when they call the Soviet Union an empire. Well, you know, sometimes they mean that it was a completely illegitimate project, which I don't fully share, because remember, you know, the Soviet Union was formed out of the crisis of the Russian Empire and out of the crisis of World War I, when most of the states were actually empires. Remember, decolonization happened just in the middle of the 20th century, not in the early 20th century. And when people say it's an empire, they mean it's illegitimate, but it's very anachronistic. It's not true of the time. But I also mean to say that the Soviet Union was formed by the people, not by the Bolsheviks, but by the people who experienced the crisis of the empire in the early 20th century and really wanted to build a reformed political state. I wouldn't agree that the Soviet Union was doomed from the very beginning because it was multinational. Many of the states at that time were multinational. But it is true that with Stalin, with this kind of approach to diversity that centers on territorial unit and, you know, purely defined ethnicity that holds this unit, that was in many respects a rupture with a previous pattern of hybrid connections, of intersectional diversity, of many linkages across the space. And that element makes it a kind of empire because it singles out the management of diversity in a particular way that enhances the control and really sort of precludes the development of other autonomous social forces in the space of heterogeneity or diversity or difference, to put it very simply. Many people also say, and I want to say that, many people say the collapse of the Soviet Union. And usually the story goes like, well, you see, the Soviet Union lost the Cold War, the competition, and then it was illegitimate anyway, and therefore, you know, collapse means an old building really cannot stand, cannot hold together, and then it collapses, you know, it sort of smashes everything. But there was a perestroika. And remember, there was a movement of reform and there was a mobilization. You know, I actually try to think about that as a kind of revolution, as a kind of, you know, many forces coming together without a clear picture of what to be done. It's a very different time, a very different society. But still, I wouldn't downplay the mobilization, the idea that you need to get a reform at that moment. Therefore, it's not so much a collapse, but a very contradictory moment of the revolution with various ideas in circulation. Unfortunately, the ideas of nationalism were prevailing at that time, and conservatism too. Remember, get back to capitalism, don't invent anything, you know, don't think much about the pensions and the social welfare state, you know, just get back to capitalism. We need to restart a century ago or something like that. And that was very unfortunate. And that's why out of this very creative moment, none of the original designs, none of the original blueprints worked to prevent the course of history that really put us forward into the past. And forward into the past, we're back to nationalism and we're back to wars. Unfortunately, now the war is legitimized. And now we are facing the situation when we have a prevalence of methodological nationalism. All of a sudden, people are saying, you deconstruct nationalism, but in fact, it is a very active force. This is the one that needs to be applauded. This is the one that is a movement towards the future. Mm. And that I think, you know, is misrepresentation of what is happening, even in the current crisis.
Sasha, our mini series is entitled The Empire Strikes Back. The Empire struck back also on yourself, on your professional career. We have already mentioned that you left Russia. The war that Russia has started against Ukraine has changed your life as well. What does the current political situation mean for you as a professional historian? How does it affect your career and your personal life?
I was asked in 2012 to start a new department of history and a research institute called the Center for Historical Research. And we've got wonderful team of faculty and researchers. And when we looked at people who are specializing in social history, in global history, in colonial imperial history, in cultural history, in diplomatic history, we all ended up saying that we are all brought under the umbrella of global comparative and transnational history. And this was our project for 20 years, for 10 years, I'm sorry. So this October would have been 10 years of our work. And we've done good things, you know, good students. And
if you say we, you're talking about the Higher School of Economics in St. Petersburg.
That is very right. That's the Higher School of Economics or HSC University in St. Petersburg. And of course, the war ended the core of our mission, that is building international cooperation, research and educational cooperation with world-leading universities in EU, in the UK, in the US. That turn has made impossible for me to carry on the mission on which I was invited. But also, I couldn't agree with the use of history that is in the Russian official politics and with the direction of the sort of political imagination that centers on rebuilding the Soviet Union 2.0. Like, let's recreate the Soviet Union, but, you know, a more modernized, a more effective version of it. Because I think it's very autarkic. It's cutting off the ties and entanglements that has been part of the Soviet, by the way, history and the post-Soviet Russian history. It does not sit well with the Russian society, particularly the young generations whose future is taken away. And therefore, I resigned these positions. I see a major problem is that we've been not that successful. Again, in resisting a very conservative attitude in Russia, in public, in educational sphere too, to say that we're facing a new century and it will bring new challenges, the one that we didn't know in the 19th century, the 17th century. So we need to have a different attitude towards history. We need to look at the history with the idea of how do you estrange or make less hegemonic the discourses that are inherited from the past. Something that says the state is the only point of political loyalty. That something that says that The only form of social solidarity is a national solidarity, the only true one. Something that says that culture has to be pure and defined by the boundaries of language and a particular cultural upbringing, a kind of a Bildungsrahmen culture. I mean, this is not true about the beginning of the 21st century, and I'm sure more in the 21st century we'll see more of a mixture, more of a contradictions that are coming out of the mixture and entanglements. And that's why we wanted to build a very different sort of department. Now, unfortunately, that work has been upended, but we've produced a number of graduates that are around the world, that are being employed, that are doing professional history. And I don't see that 10 years were completely wasted.
That's very good to hear. And then because, you know, it's a major turning point for you, for your work, for the work you've been doing. I'm very grateful that you share this with us and our audience here. My last question, because you've been talking about the changes history or the way of looking at history underwent in the last two decades, and what has happened when it comes to the politicization of history. What do you think could or should historians do to counter the political abuse or use of history as we see it now? I mean, you've been talking about your students, you've been educating younger generations. I mean, is it educating young, good historians to counter it? Should historians speak up more clearly? Should they enter into political debates and raise their voice? What is your view on this?
I mean, usually when historians are asked these questions, they're saying historians are not politicians. Of course.
I know.
they're not going to replace and have a different job. They have a different job to do. But I think it is very important for a historical profession that centers in Eastern Europe and Russian imperial or Soviet history to look back at the past 20 years and ask a question. 20 years passed. The Soviet Union is no more, and we still call the space the post-Soviet space. Mm. There is a major change of the political borders, a major change of the societies, and we, still call them, you know, Russian history. So, you know, why didn't the narrative change? Maybe the true role of a historian is not to dispute particular fact in a writing of a particular politician, but maybe to look at the major questions that the present society is facing, and to look back into the past and write a different narrative from a different angle, from a different perspective. I always use in this situation the example of gender history and women's history. You know, when people say, well, history doesn't really change, but is it really so? We've seen professional history ignoring the question of women as if they did not exist. And now we have a very different history. Right? So the past is very rich and complex. And every new generation asks different questions to the past. And I think the way we tell the story, the way we shape the narrative should not be conservative. That is, repeat because, you know, that is going to sell well. but to challenge the society with the questions and not to be very arrogant about society. I think society is ready to listen to very different parts of history, complex and difficult history, but we need not to be arrogant about society. We should trust society and provide society with this material to reflect on the present questions. And again, if you look at the current state of almost all societies, they all experience diversity, and they're all struggling with it, because diversity is not always good. Diversity is about the conflict, is about the various forms of identification, is about the norms that are seemingly incompatible. But this is the reality, and the only other alternative to that is cleansing and genocide. So we'd better start thinking about how to write a narrative of history, how to explain how people live together, being in diverse societies and in very huge political formations. And maybe that will bring to the present society some insight of what to do with the issue of diversity today.
This was our podcast episode with Alexander Semyonov about the use and abuse of imperial history as a weapon in Russian politics. We've collected more information about the work of Alexander Semyonov and about some of the topics that we discussed in this episode for you in the show notes. Further information on our History and Politics podcast and the work we are doing at the History and Politics Department can be found on the website of Körber Stiftung. Most of our podcast episodes so far were published in German, but from now on, we will also produce more episodes in English. This summer, for example, we will have 4 special English language editions dealing with the New Germany, which means with the historical context of Zeitenwende or the watershed moment. We are very proud that these episodes will be hosted by British German historian Katja Heuer and by Oliver Moody, who is the Berlin correspondent of the Times. So stay tuned with our History and Politics podcast to be the first to listen to the friendly takeover that we arranged with our 2 temporarily co-hosts in July and August. That's all for the moment. Thank you for listening. Take care and goodbye. And as we say in Hamburg, tschüss, machen Sie's gut.